So, Mr. Jack Grace, Martini Cowboy, our good friend, Merry Christmas to you, sir.
Thank you, and a very happy, merry this and that to you and everyone.
I guess a musical guy such as yourself spends Christmas Eve out caroling among the picturesque byways of Norman Rockwell, America. Am I right?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's exactly what happens, John.
And like all musicians, you hold it as a personal spiritual duty to bring holiday cheer and good wishes to people everywhere, no?
In my own way, yes, that's what happens.
Yeah. Peace on earth, goodwill toward men is what gets you musicians out of bed in these holidays of song and sentiment, right?
Yes, that. And getting paid doesn't hurt at all.
And I understand you wrote a song for us this morning on The Takeaway.
Yes, I did. It goes like this. Santa Claus, won't you shoot my balls for Christmas? He's a really bad boy, don't deserve no toys at all. Santa Claus, won't you shoot...
Jack, couldn't you have just stuck to Jingle Bells or Frosty this morning?
No can do, Hockenberry. Is this a union gig?
Absolutely. Merry Christmas. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Wednesday and it's Christmas Eve. That means it's December 24th. And I think Jack Grace is actually putting me in the holiday spirit.
Jack Grace,
there's
is
no
in the
good
house.
In being Scrooge on That's Christmas
true.
Eve.
That is true. Good morning, Adora.
Good morning, everyone. This hour, we're going to look at why finding out where the Bush administration bailout money has gone is so hard. We'll be asking some tough questions about that. And music composed by, you could say, Phish. A few pages for America's briefing book on the economy and national security. Those stories are coming up. First, these headlines.
So, major travel delays in the Midwest and the Northwest. Hundreds of flights have been canceled around the country. A dozen deaths are blamed on dangerous roads. Check the forecast. Even if the weather's good at your airport, you're going to have to deal with security. Transportation Security Administration spokeswoman Ellen Howe says they plan all year for the holiday crowds.
The holidays for us are like our version of the Super Bowl.
If it doesn't feel like a tailgate party standing in line for the TSA, maybe they should serve guacamole.
Guacamole, okay. A long-awaited report on the Obama transition team, their contacts with Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich is out. Incoming White House counsel Greg Craig says none of the president-elect's people did anything wrong.
We are satisfied there was nothing inappropriate that took place here, either in terms of conversations or communications or contacts.
The report says incoming White House Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel was the only transition staffer to talk directly with Governor Blagojevich. The president-elect, meanwhile, is in Hawaii for the Christmas holiday. Yesterday, he attended a memorial service there for his late grandmother. President Bush is at Camp David.
Economic news later this hour. It's just a half day of trading on Wall Street, and Christmas is providing a boon for people who have to buy gasoline and oil. Oil is trading in the 30s, around $38 a barrel. So Jack Grace has created a holiday jukebox from hell. What can you do about that?
Hi, this is Michael from Eatontown, New Jersey. One of my favorite Christmas songs is Do You Hear What I Hear?
A song, a song.
The Vanessa Williams version there, 8778-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Now, if it were you or me who were lending other people's money at the rate of, you know, $700 billion, $300 billion, $50 billion out to financial institutions all over the world, it might occur to you to actually write down who you were loaning the money to and what was securing these loans. But apparently, the transparency promised by the Treasury Secretary and the Fed Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke during the negotiations for the financial bailout has not materialized. A couple of months in, we actually don't know where much of the financial bailout money is going. Bloomberg News and the Fox Business Network have filed Freedom of Information Act requests for information. Fox has now filed an actual lawsuit. Dan Gross, senior editor of Newsweek, joins us now on the line from Connecticut. Dan, thanks for being a part of the program.
Good morning, John.
What is the mechanism for accountability here? And we've spoken as recently as about a month ago with some individuals on Capitol Hill who said that much of the mechanism for oversight wasn't in place yet, but was getting there. It sounds as though nothing much has happened.
So, well, in theory, we were supposed to get updates from Treasury, Henry Paulson, and from the Federal Reserve, the two parties that are implementing this, and in practice, they have been less than forthcoming. I don't know if you mentioned it, but Bloomberg News and I believe Fox Business Channel have basically filed, Freedom of Information Act and other types of lawsuits trying to get them to disgorge this information. I think there are kind of three factors at work here. One, the Federal Reserve. There's a great book about the Fed called Secrets of the Temple. So they're accustomed to operating largely in secret and in privacy.
That's the William Grider book, right?
Yes.
It's about Volcker's period.
Exactly.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
But this notion that, it's this kind of black box. You don't see what's going in there. There's no C-SPAN. They disclose what they want to disclose because they're this independent entity. A second thing you have is sort of the Wall Street arrogance, where it's the bank saying, we'll take the money, but we're not going to tell you what we're doing with it or how much we got because, this kind of legacy of arrogance and hubris. And the third is what I would call the kind of Jack Nicholson factor. If you remember A Few Good Men and the scene in the courtroom where he says, you can't handle the truth.
Yeah.
Remember that? Part of what's going on here is that the Fed and Treasury have basically taken on or lent against all these assets to these banks. And the fear is that if it was really disclosed to the market just how little a lot of these, junky mortgages and CDOs and funky securities, if the public and the markets at large knew precisely what they were worth, which would be a low number because there is no market for these now,
right?
That would cause a whole new series of freakouts and trigger the same type of situation we had in the spring where people, these financial institutions, suffer effective run on the banks. I'd compare it to, let's say this is something we could all understand. If we all bought condos in a building and we all paid $1 million and we all borrowed $800,000.
Mm-hmm.
We had these nice condos, and the market started going south. And we all thought that, okay, maybe their value was down to $900,000. But nothing was really selling. And there was one guy who really needed to move, and he got his rich uncle to sort of buy his condo, but he was only able to sell it for $300,000. Now, everybody else in the condo, wouldn't want that information to get out there. Because all of a sudden that establishes a new market. If someone was only willing to pay $300,000, how could everybody else be valuing it at two and three times? And then you could imagine what would happen. The banks that lend those condos.
But Dan, aren't we already there, though? That's the question. We know they're not worth anything near what they are on paper. And this lack of transparency just seems outrageous. Do you buy the argument that if you release the information, it signals weakness and therefore will make it harder for the economy to bounce back, the financial economy to bounce back?
I buy that, but I think our need as a great democracy, that one of the principles is that the people have some knowledge of where their money is going, I think that imperative outweighs the negative side. We've already told the world and told each other that the government is going to do whatever it takes to get us out of this mess, several hundred billion dollar bailout, $1 trillion stimulus package, you name it. And so this notion that institutions and the market somehow can't handle the truth, I think, it would certainly be negative, but we've committed to dealing with the outcomes, and we've also committed, when you spend money without having taxes to pay for it, it's essentially a huge tax increase on people in the next few years or the next generation.
Well, let's talk for a minute about the numbers for a second. you know, I understand the sort of cultural argument that you're making, which explains the behavior of these folks, that they're used to secrecy, that when we hear we're doing everything to solve this crisis, whatever it takes, we're going to do. In fact, what they're hearing is more along the lines of, leave us alone, we're taking care of it, we don't want you in our way. That I get. But what are the numbers that we really don't know here? I mean, what checks have been written that are just kind of out there in the ether, Dan?
Well, it's not so much checks, because the TARP, right, that was the bailout legislation passed in the fall, which gave the Treasury Department, you know, up to $700 billion. And that was where, you know, we went to each bank and say, okay, Chase, you take $20 billion, you know, First National, whatever, you take $500 million, et cetera. There has been some transparency in that. The question there is, okay, what are those banks now going to do with it? So that's the direct expenditures.
Right.
But at the same time, the Federal Reserve has been lending hundreds of billions of dollars through various programs and one-off arrangements, et cetera. And when they lend, it's not like, you know, you sign a mortgage and they give you money and I guess they have a claim against your house. When you lend, it's frequently against collateral. So, you know, I'm a bank. I have what I think are $100 million of mortgages, and I will present that. I will put that up as collateral, and they'll lend me, you know, some percentage of that. They'll lend me $80 million
right.
against the $100 million.
So the
that's been going on a very large scale.
And the Treasury believes that its lending component of all of this bailout is not subject to traditional accounting and congressional oversight?
That's kind of the message we're getting.
You can't handle the truth!
Dan, you're right. I can't handle the truth. You're actually correct on that. Dora.
You need me in that Federal Reserve, in that marble building.
I mean, Dan, we're talking about at least $2 trillion from what's been reported, and a lot of this money was prior to the bailout plan. So at what point are we as taxpayers going to be able to know exactly where all of this money is going?
Well, you would hope that when we have a new administration and a new Congress coming in, that there will be kind of more aggressive oversight and demands. I think part of what's going on here is that, we've talked about the motivations of the people involved. When you start to break down the politics, you know, who in Washington is going to stand up and get red in the face and scream about this? You know, it wasn't the Bush administration. It wasn't the Republicans, well, maybe some of the Republicans in the House and Senate who opposed this, but they're essentially powerless. And you look at who runs things on the Democratic side, you know, Chris Dodd, Chuck Schumer, Hillary Clinton, Frank Lautenberg. These are the senators from the states of financial services. They are very invested in the system and likewise. So to expect the head of the Senate Finance Committee to stand up and start cracking heads together about this, we might not
right.
get that from this crowd.
Lautenberg doesn't even want transparency. He lost a ton of money in the Madoff scandal. So, I mean, you can't really expect demands from him. All right, quickly, before we go, is it possible that as we move out of the sort of emergency zone of this financial bailout and begin to write new rules for how to deal with this fundamentally new role for the Fed, that we're going to get some of these mechanisms in place and we're going to learn more of how the Fed is actually lending?
I would certainly hope so. You know, for decades, when the Fed was basically an independent agency, it's owned by its member banks. It doesn't necessarily get an appropriation from Treasury every year. And so its argument for the lack of transparency was, you know, we're not a part of the executive branch. We're not like the Treasury Department or the State Department. We don't have a line item budget that Congress, you know, we have this job to do. We're owned by the banks. We get our money from where we get it, and we do with it what we please because, you know, we're managing interest rates.
A hope for transparency is kind of a hope for the holidays in this new world for the Fed. Dan Gross, senior editor of Newsweek. Merry Christmas, Dan, and thanks.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. We've got kind of a holiday karmic smackdown going here. We've got Jack Grace, our friend, the Martini Cowboy, who has culled some of the worst holiday songs that you've ever heard, and he'll have them later on in the program. But we want you to counter that. We want the best songs. We want the songs that you love, the songs that really bring your spirit up in this holiday season. And, you know, I guess some of you prefer bad.
This is Dan calling from New York City. My worst Christmas song by far is that one from the Beatles that's Simply Having a Wonderful Christmas Time, the one that sounds like they played it on a synthesizer that they stole from the back of a Radio Shack somewhere. Yeah, that just because the Beatles wrote it doesn't make it good.
That was McCartney's band before Wings, which actually did this tune here. But we want to hear your favorites, your favorite holiday songs, the ones that make you feel good, give you the glow. 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org. We got Jack for the other stuff.
And yeah, we'll be hearing from him shortly. But right now, James Rickards is on the line with us from Darien, Connecticut. He's a senior managing director for market intelligence at Omnis, an applied research firm. And he has a few pages for America's briefing book for President-elect Obama. And his pages, well, they're not for the faint-hearted. When it comes to national security, he argues the U.S. needs to be on guard for massive threats to our economic stability. Welcome and good morning, James.
Good morning, Adora.
So what's keeping you up at night?
Well, these threats that we've been talking about, I probably should make it clear, they're not predictions. These are not things that anyone thinks will happen. They're things that might happen. And the question for the United States is, how prepared are we? Traditionally, you know, military, national security, intelligence professionals have all looked at physical threats, weapons, and obviously weapons of mass destruction, cyber warfare, and so forth. We're developing a new field of basically financial warfare, what's sometimes called threat finance, and suggesting that the United States needs to be just as diligent in that area as we are in other areas.
I should add that you were general counsel of the hedge fund Long-Term Capital Management. You oversaw its rescue by the Federal Reserve in its spectacular crash.
Correct.
What kinds of threats to the economy do you think the Obama administration needs to prioritize and take a look at?
Well, there are a number of them. One would be kind of manipulation of markets. Our foreign rivals, you know, not every country that opposes us is an outright enemy. We have some more in the enemy camp, maybe Iran, North Korea, and others, but we have certainly rivalries with Russia and China. And they can do a lot of things for good, but they can also do manipulative things. A simple example, Russia controls a large percentage of the natural gas going into Europe. That's well known, and Russia has the ability to turn off that natural gas, and they actually did so once in supplies to the Ukraine. Now, take that a step further. What if they were going to turn off the natural gas, but in advance of that, they went out and bought some natural gas futures contracts on the New York Mercantile Exchange? Now you go ahead and turn off the gas, the price goes up, and they make money on the futures. So it's kind of a insider trading, if you will, on your own inside information. Those are the kind of manipulations that we've always looked for in the criminal context, and I'm just suggesting we need to look for that in the national security context.
But how do you secure yourself against that kind of threat when you don't control the natural gas? And that certainly is a negotiating point for the Russians as they deal with Europe.
Right. Well, that's a much larger issue, obviously. Natural gas supplies, you know, it's kind of a world market. And I think from an energy perspective, certainly the United States needs to be developing all of its resources. So my particular point is not that I'm an energy expert or a cyber expert per se, but more that these things connect to the financial system. And that really is my background, the area of expertise. And I'm just trying to say that some of these threats that people are familiar with in other contexts can play out in the financial arena. Particularly, you take Al-Qaeda after 9/11 when bin Laden made his first appearance. It was a videotape of a dinner he had in Afghanistan. And he immediately started talking about the stock market. He knew exactly how much the New York Stock Exchange had gone down, had a rough approximation of the amount of losses. And Al-Qaeda has explicitly said that imposing financial damage on the United States is one of their goals. Now, we know the economy...
Well, but James, let me just ask one question here. And being involved with long-term capital management, I suspect you know a lot about this. I mean,
I'm an expert on financial disasters.
Right. I mean, there were two Nobel Prize winners who helped to found that fund.
Right.
And, you know, that plus the Madoff scandal here, I mean, is it smart, evil people we have to worry about, or smart... I don't want to say stupid, but misguided people that we have to worry about.
I think we need to worry about both, and again, without getting into individual personalities. LTCM, the collapse in 1998, lost $4 billion in about a period of a month, was this crisis in a Petri dish. At the time, markets almost came to a halt. $4 billion seemed like an enormous amount of money. Today, it seems like spare change because we're talking about $4 to $8 trillion of bailout money. So certainly a much smaller crisis by that measure, but all of the lessons were there, and I would say none of them were learned. In particular, Alan Greenspan was very vocal in opposing any kind of derivatives regulation. Well, we should have learned from LTCM that derivatives do need to be regulated in some way. I don't want the government out there telling hedge funds and traders, you know, do this or don't do that. That's not the government's role. But it's kind of like the difference between a baseball player and an umpire. You don't want the government going out on the field with a glove and a hat and playing the game, but you do want somebody behind the plate calling balls and strikes. And the government, starting with the Clinton administration, continuing, I would say, through the Bush administration and Greenspan principally, simply failed to do that. I mean, one thing in particular, the derivatives contracts can do a lot of good. Greenspan said, take them and take an amount of risk. Instead of putting it in one place, slice it up in pieces and sell it to all the people who are in the best position to bear the risk. Well, that actually makes sense, but what he failed to understand is that we would increase the quantum of risk so much. So he had the first-order benefit of diversification. He had that right. But he ignored the second-order cost of expanding the system way beyond anything we've seen before.
So you're really talking about economic policy as opposed to a national security policy that would help mitigate the potential downsides. But before you answer that, get to the threat that you believe potentially China poses, given the fact that they hold somewhere around $500 billion worth of U.S. Treasury bonds.
Right, $500 billion would actually be a low estimate. The number's probably well in excess of a trillion at this point. But, by the way, just to be clear, in this crisis so far, China has absolutely been a partner of the United States. They've been on their best behavior. But things can change. We've seen that before in the, I always go back to the Hitler-Stalin pact where, they were friends until they weren't. And China just sitting there doing nothing has kind of large veto power over a lot of interest rate and exchange rate policies in the United States. We're trying to depreciate our currency a little bit to stimulate exports and create jobs in this country. Most Americans would say that's a good thing, but you're the Chinese. You're sitting there with, upwards of $2 trillion of U.S. dollar-denominated securities, and you see our exchange rate going down. That's basically taking money out of their pocket, as the cliche goes. We're drinking their milkshake. And,
but certainly a lot for, we're going to have to leave it there, certainly
sure.
A lot for Barack Obama to consider. Thank you for your thoughts this morning, James Rickards.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me on.
James Rickards is a senior managing director for market intelligence at Omnis, a few pages for America's briefing book.
Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. Headlines now from Femi Okeh.
Hello there. Good morning. The time is 28 minutes to the top of the hour. Just getting in some economic data, all coming in one big lot. For November, personal spending drops for the fifth straight month. That's the longest stretch in half a century. Jobless claims figures 586,000. That's to the end of last week. And durable goods down by 1%. In other news, President Bush has granted 19 new pardons. Those pardons span the decade, convicted of a whole variety of crimes. Several high-profile pardon seekers, including well-known politicians, are not on the list. And the president has granted 190 pardons during his two terms. And that's fewer than President Clinton or Reagan. There are reports of Palestinian militants firing rockets into southern Israel. And that hurts the plans of diplomats who've been working to revive an expired truce between Hamas and Israel. Egypt is trying to bridge the Israeli-Palestinian gap. And tomorrow, Israel's foreign minister meets with Egypt's president in Cairo. Somalia's appointed prime minister is resigning after only a week on the job. Parliament refused to back his appointment. And that's a look at your news for now.
Thank you, Femi. So we go now to Bruce Walker, who's a professor of psychology and computing at the Georgia Tech, which is doing some of the greatest research into human-machine interfaces. He joins us from Atlanta. Bruce, thanks for being part of the program.
Good morning. Great to be here.
Now, I wanted to bring you on the show because I want you to listen to this and tell me what's going on here.
Well, certainly, as anyone can plainly hear, this is a sonification of a fish in an aquarium.
Now, I can't see an aquarium, all right? So in a sense, I'm just like the blind people you composed this for. How did you make this music, and what is its purpose?
Well, this project is the Accessible Aquarium Project, and it's really a collaborative effort based on the idea that most dynamic exhibits in a zoo or an aquarium is really inaccessible to people who can't see it. And in fact, it's the very dynamics that makes these exhibits interesting and makes us want to come back that also makes it difficult to communicate to someone who's blind or has a vision impairment. So we basically track the fish and then convert their movements into a variety of different styles of music in an effort to provide blind people with something when they go to an aquarium.
All right, let's just talk for a second about the hardware, because I'm such a gadget geek. You've got some sort of camera that's like actually watching the fish in the tank. You capture the motion, you plot the trajectories and come up with some sort of algorithm to make sounds associated with each blob that's moving?
Exactly. We start with a very simple...
Exactly. You can't say exactly. There's no possible way that's exactly right.
Well, I guess it's looking behind the curtain here, but it's fairly simple and straightforward in its core. There is a camera that, or multiple cameras that watch the fish in the fish tank and figure out where the different fish are, which it identifies the fish by color and shape and size, follows their movement, and then once we know where the different fish are, we convert those movement paths into music in a variety of ways.
So the music that we're hearing represents many fish or different schools of fish or a fish?
Indeed. Well, we'll start with one fish, and we might, for example, have a fish represented by the sound of a trumpet. As that fish moves to the left of the tank, the trumpet sound would move to your left ear or the left speaker. As the fish moves to the right, then the trumpet follows it to the right side of the stereo space. As the fish goes up or down, we change the pitch of the trumpet up or down in the musical scale.
What if it's a big shark?
As it gets, say again?
What if it's a big shark?
If it's a big shark, then it's going to be a big instrument like a cello or a bass, whereas a jellyfish would be maybe a piccolo or a flute.
Jellyfish is a piccolo
so
or a flute.
Interesting.
So what are these here?
I believe those are the sounds of yellow tangs. They're a medium-sized fish, and they're not moving very quickly. If you threw some fish food into that tank, the fish would certainly speed up chasing the food around. In fact, those may be the sounds of ants.
Yes.
Ants wandering around.
So you can actually use this technique to simulate or create a musical soundtrack for the motion of all kinds of creatures.
We can indeed. We can anything that moves, we can track, whether it's ants or fish or birds or people.
Now,
and then we can convert that into some kind of appropriate music.
Now, Bruce, it seems like the big advantage you have here is that everybody knows when they go to a museum, it's much more than just the visual. There's a whole sense of scale and depth and being in a place that makes great museums and great exhibits work. But I'm wondering if when blind people have used your device and used your sonification, if they say, oh, this is great, this is an aquarium, or if they just say, you know, I actually prefer to just have my mother explain it to me what's going on in the tank.
All of the experiences that we've had, all of the feedback that we've had so far has been very positive. One of the things we're relying a lot on is the fact that music can be such an emotional experience as well. Standing in front of a 60-foot wall of glass and watching a whale shark cruise by is an emotional experience and not just visual. So we're trying to make sure that we convey the emotion as well as the dynamics. And by choosing the right kinds of music, we can really be effective for the blind people. And they get it, they like it, and they want more of it.
And sighted people can appreciate this as well.
Indeed, we take a universal design approach so that everything we do is not unique or specific to people who can't see the exhibit. What we do is going to enhance the experience for everyone.
So I'm closing my eyes now. Is Nemo in there? Is there a clownfish in there?
I think you're hearing some wrasses and maybe some medium-sized fish. If we hear a dome, 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 then you can tell the whale shark's coming by.
Yeah, I think John Williams owns the rights to that particular theme. Well, this is great. And where's
this great project?
Where's it going to be tried first?
We have a live fish tank that's being tracked and producing music all the time in our labs, and we're working with local aquariums to get it installed and tested in a bigger scale.
All right, well, Bruce Walker, thanks so much for being a part of the program, and happy holidays to you.
My pleasure.
You got a song that you love, Christmas song?
Oh, I'm going old school. I'm dreaming of a white Christmas. I'm a Canadian boy down here in Georgia.
All right, Bruce Walker, Associate Professor of Psychology and Computing with the Sonification Lab at Georgia Tech. Thanks so much, Bruce.
All right, bye-bye.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. Imagine making this confession. People think I'm horrible for telling my child there is no Santa. That post on the blog Post Secret, where people from around the world write in to confess their secrets, resonated for single mom Amber Stogner from Bismarck, North Dakota. When economic stress threatens to cancel Christmas, it seems for some families like Santa has been laid off. So Amber posted her own difficult story, and it began a chain of Christmas giving that circled the world. Amber is with us. Amber, first of all, why would you ever tell your child there's no Santa?
Well, times are tough for people. If you're a single mom and you ever get stuck not being able to work because you're sick or you hurt your back or you don't have a job or you've been laid off, you know, if you don't have the money for Christmas, you might have to end up telling your children that Santa's not real or Santa can't bring them what they work so hard being a good boy or good girl for all year.
And that's the experience you found yourself in this year, right?
Yes. It's been a tough year for everybody around the nation, but particularly it hits a little closer to home for me.
But people online who saw your story and understood the details of your predicament responded.
Yes, I got responses, over 300 responses from all over the world.
And these are emails of people saying, hey, wait a minute, it's not so bad, or were these people actually trying to help you?
Well, Frank Warren, the creator of Post Secret, had asked me to create a PayPal account. And so I did go forward and do that. And he posted my information on Post Secret for, I believe, 9 a.m. that Monday. And people sent me responses, and they sent me small donations ranging anywhere from, like, $3 to $5, maybe a little bit more. So, and then they would add little messages of hope with it. So
And this was this was like December 15th. This was just a couple weeks ago, right?
Correct, yes.
And one response, and these are typical, I am a college student with a limited budget, but it would be a lovely Christmas present for me if I were able to put a smile on the faces of two strangers on Christmas morning. It's fair to say the response was pretty overwhelming, right?
Absolutely. I heard that a lot, or people apologizing to me that they weren't able to give more, and I was so surprised to get anything at all because that was not my intentions.
And the amount of money was enough to actually bring Santa back into your life, right?
Will bring Santa back into my life and the life of a lot of other people that I know that are struggling. I was able to help other people out with things that they were afraid they weren't going to be able to buy for their children.
Can you read one of your favorite responses?
Well, I wasn't able to grab it to pull it up, but I do have like a basic summary. It was from a man in Northern Ireland. He sent me some money, and he had said that this was for all the mothers out there because his mother had always worked so hard to make his Christmases special.
Wow.
And he just wanted me to think of her on Christmas morning.
And Amber, Merry Christmas to you, too. There is a Santa. Amber Stogner lives in Bismarck, North Dakota. And after she wrote that, she told her kids that there was no Santa. Many online Santas came through and chipped in to give her family a genuine Christmas online. Here's someone who wrote in to say, I made a donation, and I was surprised how good it felt. One does not have to be a millionaire to feel the joy of being generous. Extra good credit. Karma to Amber from an online poster there. Christmas spirit, you've got it.
Hi, I'm Christiane Chase from Enid, Oklahoma. And along with most other Oklahomans, the song I can't get out of my head is a commercial for a local jewelry store, B.C. Clark's, that's been in business in Oklahoma City since 1892. It just isn't Christmas in Oklahoma until we hear the B.C. Clark jingle. And it goes like this. Jewelry is the gift you give. This is the gift that'll live and live. So give the gift you know can't fail. From B.C.
Clark's. Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. It's Christmas Eve, December 24th, and Femi Oke is here with our headlines of the hour.
Oh, I'm getting excited. 30 minutes to the top of the hour. Good morning, everybody. Out this morning, some fresh numbers on how the economy is doing. New claims for jobless benefits jumped more than expected to 586,000. That's a 26-year high. Durable goods orders fall smaller than expected, 1% in November. And November personal spending drops for a fifth straight month. That's the longest stretch in about 50 years. Palestinian militants in Gaza fired rockets into southern Israel today. That's another setback for diplomats who've been working to revive a truce between them that expired over the weekend. Egypt is trying to bridge the Israeli-Palestinian gap. Israel's foreign minister will meet with Egypt's president in Cairo tomorrow. The Obama family attended a private memorial service in Hawaii yesterday for Barack Obama's grandmother. She helped raise him there. Madeline Payne Dunham died on November the 2nd, and after the ceremony, President-elect Obama scattered her ashes into the ocean. The junior officers who have seized power in Guinea have accused some generals loyal to the former government of trying to bring mercenaries into Guinea. In a broadcast on national TV, the coup leaders promised to hold free and credible elections in 2 years' time. And finally, here's one for the children listening. I'm just getting reports that Santa has left the North Pole, and that's the latest news. That serious now, Adora? Latest news just coming in from NORAD, the North American Aerospace Defense Command.
They got something to do.
Every year they run a Santa tracking service, and NORAD reporter John Loboto is tracking Santa's progress.
Santa is flying south along the coast of Russia, going through the Bering Strait, heading south. His sled appears to be fully loaded, and the reindeer are traveling at full speed ahead.
Good to hear that. If you want to track Santa's progress as well, NORADSanta.org, and that's the big news of the morning.
Thank you, Fem.
So much, Fem.
NORAD tracking Santa?
You can't handle the truth.
That's right. It's Christmas. Can you handle the truth about Christmas? That's why we asked Jack Grace, the Martini Cowboy, to come in and, you know, explore musically the dark side of Christmas, stuff that really gets under your skin, not the traditional carols. We've actually We've gotten responses from our listeners actually all week on this, and we wanted to bring you in, Jack, because we know you're an expert on this.
Sure. Well, today I'm here to talk about atrocious music. That's plain and simple.
You're kind of assembling a jukebox of the all-time worst Christmas songs that you've managed to find.
At first, it was against my nature to find music that I wouldn't want to listen to, but then it became a complete joy.
Because why? You have to explain that, Jack.
Well, once you enter the gates of hell, you find out it's not so bad. It's just a little hot in there. But and this is the first song that we have coming up. Now, Adora and I are the same age, so we did, you know.
Are we really?
We are. Yeah, we are. Pretty close.
Okay.
And I think you remember in high school when we were off frolicking, having good times, Knight Rider was on TV.
I do recall Knight Rider.
Yes.
Kit.
And we have, if you can believe it, 1983, this first song was released. It is a Knight Rider Christmas.
The night was cold. Stories told on that fateful Christmas Eve. Snow so high, it would be July. Pour it all on free. Santa Claus can't wait for thaws, now I had to make that flight. The reindeer sailed, but the wind prevailed, and the sleigh went down that night. The darkest moment ever known.
So they hoped this would become an immortal part of Christmas? Kind of like It's a Wonderful Life or something?
Let's see, I want to see if we can get to the part where Kit actually talks in the track, because that is really the money part.
The car.
Here we go.
Kit.
I think it's coming.
Christmas.
Listen to that. The 80s were really a fascinating time in music, really.
Michael, this isn't exactly foundation business. How are you going to justify the expense?
Don't you worry about Devin. After all, this is Christmas. And besides, we're having a great time.
Great time.
All right, this is a TV show about a car, right?
Yes, it was. See, then Adora chimes in. She knows all about it.
All right, that's pretty bad. I mean, there's no way you can do worse than that, right?
The nostalgia factor in a lot of 80s music is not coming around for Christmas music. If you notice, it still doesn't. It doesn't hold up. It's not getting any sweeter. It's only getting worse. But this is just an amazing. And if you have fans out there of Knight Rider and stuff, if you have a 1983 mint condition 45 of the song, it's actually worth money.
Really?
David Hasselhoff fans there.
All right, next.
Okay, I just want to keep talking about that one because I'm so blown away. But the next song that we have for which one do we have queued up here? I believe.
Well, we can play it and you can tell.
Yeah.
Tell us.
To be pregnant at Christmas. Feel like the round yon virgin of yore, 'cause though I have a warm bed to sleep in, there's no room for me when I go to the store, 'cause the aisles are so narrow and crowded.
There is a little bit of relief on this one, in that this woman is a satirist. Her name is Nancy White.
Okay.
She's Canadian, and one of her claim to fame is that, you know, she also wrote a satirical song about Leonard Cohen, realizing that Leonard Cohen would never get to be her husband. And then she got to play Leonard Cohen's birthday party and stuff. So she's revered in Canada and does a lot of satirical songs. But I almost liked this song better when I first hearing it, thinking that somebody was singing this at face value.
Yeah, I heard this a little bit last night, and my daughters were kind of really interested in it, which was quite alarming. Here's the next song. Tell me what this is all about.
There's a Christmas card I'm sending out today from the children of the world who'd like to say something special to a man in a far distant land. And here's what the little children have to say. Mr. Russian, please don't shoot down Santa's sleigh.
Mr. Russian, please don't shoot down Santa's sleigh.
I just wish everybody out there could have seen the look on your face, Chuck.
What?
It
feels Cold War to me. What, who did this and what's it all about?
Her name is the sensational little Shauna Lynette. And after lots of research, you know, we're still looking to find out more about her.
Maybe she worked for the CIA.
Well, it's actually Karl Rove's daughter.
That's not true, correct? Yeah,
right. No, it's not.
All right, some of these really bad songs actually do have classic status. This is the only one of the ones that you sent that was recognizable to me.
Yeah.
Please, Daddy, don't get drunk this Christmas. I don't want to see my mama cry. Please, Daddy, don't get drunk this Christmas. I don't want to see my mama cry.
Now, who is that?
Now, that's what I was wondering. People out there might be recognizing that voice, saying, that's the same singer of Country Roads, Take Me Home. That is the one and only John Denver.
And he made money off this song?
Well, here's the thing. The guy that wrote the song also wrote Country Roads with John Denver. So this is a little bit, you know, different for John Denver. Obviously, his connection with this guy had him cover the song. Because Alan Jackson does a number, and somehow that's, as a country guy, it fits a little more. But this song gets covered right. A lot.
Well, and of course, you know, artists making Christmas albums is a long tradition, and a lot of songs have come from that. Let's go out on this last thing, which I can't even describe. It's so bizarre. That is not a synthesizer, right?
No, these are power tools. And that's what everybody out there...
Let's listen. Yeah.
That's actually kind of clever.
Yeah, for this amount of time, it's clever. I'll put the whole album on for you. You might feel a little different.
I can see the whole band wearing goggles, like in shop class. They sort of look like Devo.
I saw us all in goggles as we listen to it now.
Well, Jack, thanks so much for that.
It's my pleasure. Ask me for atrocious songs anytime.
We will. Jack Grace, our friend, he's the Martini Cowboy.
And so there you have it, Jack Grace's Holiday Jukebox from Hades. We want to hear your Holiday Jukebox from Heaven. Take Jack's Holiday Gloom and Doom and turn it upside down. We want to hear your favorite songs. 8778 My Take or My Take at thetakeaway.org. Here's your takeaway.
It's kind of like the difference between a baseball player and an umpire. You don't want the government going out on the field with a glove and a hat and playing the game, but you do want somebody behind the plate calling balls and strikes.
That's James Rickards, Senior Managing Director for Market Intelligence at Omnis, talking about the economy and threats to our national security.
Dylan, raise this up again. I hear a router in there. There's a couple of power drills.
I like it.
There's a
it
saw,
grows on
a
you.
Table saw. Oh, this
what
here's
is that,
the router.
The...
It's a router.
What's that?
Joy to the world, even with power tools.
No, joy to the world, but what was that little ding-ding sound? What
probably
tool?
Probably some wrenches. A saw? Who knows?
I'm
John Hockenberry.
I'm Adora Udoji.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
One nation, two presidents.
Pardon me, but I think you're the one, love, that I've been waiting on for so long. Pardon me, could we...
George W. Bush issues some presidential pardons and spends the holidays at Camp David while the president-elect watches moonbeams in Hawaii. The Bush era ends, and the Obama era, what will that be like?
I've often said this year that I'm not quite sure what this phrase means, but I think he's a postmodern candidate and president.
Tom Brokaw on Obama. It's a postmodern radio program.
Pardon me, but I think you're the one, love, that I've been waiting on for so long. Pardon me, could we walk in the moonlight just to see, dear, if I'm right?
Postmodern bluegrass. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, December 24th, Christmas Eve.
Postmodern pre-Christmas radio program. Good morning, Adora.
Yes, and Tom Brokaw is going to share his thoughts on 2009 with us today. Also today, we're going to take a look at President Bush and, well, he's begun the tradition of pardons just weeks before he leaves office. Also, dinner with Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe and America's briefing book on food for President-elect Obama. Those stories coming up. First, these headlines.
Major travel delays today, especially in the Midwest and Northwest. Hundreds of flights have been canceled around the country. There are a dozen deaths blamed on dangerous roads. The Seattle mail carrier says that the gifts aren't going to make it in time.
Some people may be getting Christmas presents a little bit late this year.
That's kind of sad. President-elect Barack Obama's team is explaining contacts with Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich in a new report. Incoming White House counsel Greg Craig says the transition team didn't know about any plans to sell or trade the Illinois Senate seat.
No one in the Obama circle was aware of what was going on in the governor's office or in the governor's mind until such time as he was arrested.
Incoming White House Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel was the only transition staffer to talk directly with Governor Blagojevich. The president-elect is in Hawaii, as we said, for the Christmas holiday. He attended a memorial service there for his late grandmother, and President Bush is at Camp David.
Some key economic numbers just out this morning. Hard to find any good news in the data, unfortunately. Jobless numbers are worse than analysts expected. Big-ticket manufacturing orders dropped 1%, and personal spending dropped for a fifth straight month. That's the longest streak of cutbacks in half a century. Asian markets closed mostly down this morning. Major European markets are down somewhat. And add crude oil to the list of holiday deals available this morning. It's been trading as low as $37 a barrel.
That's down since we went on the air. You can't give that stuff away. The Dow was down 1% yesterday. Futures are off this morning. The markets will open for the last half day of trading, probably negative. So holiday jukebox from hell, that's the idea. But we want you to do the opposite of our friend Jack Grace, the Martini Cowboy.
I just wanted to say that my favorite Christmas song now is "O Holy Night," and that's ever since Josh Groban sang it.
That's right. Slow it down. Your best songs of the holidays. 8778 My Take.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. We're going to start this morning with presidential pardons. With just weeks left in his administration, President Bush has started granting some pardons. So far, 19 people, among them convicted drug dealers, armed dealers, and embezzlers, have received pardons. None of the names are high-profile lawbreakers, but many of the offenders have long since served their sentences. New York Times reporter Eric Lischblau wrote a front-page story in today's paper about one of Bush's pardons. He joins us from Maryland. Good morning, Eric.
Good morning.
So you wrote about Charlie Winters. Who is he? What did he do? And why did Bush pardon him?
Well, he's a fascinating character that no doubt many people have never even heard of. Charlie Winters was a businessman in Miami during World War II who was in the purchasing business for military supplies, and through sort of an odd series of circumstances ended up supplying military aircraft to Israel during the War of Independence in Israel in 1948. And he actually personally flew one B-17 bomber to Europe to aid the Israelis in fortifying air defenses. And he was, along with two other men from the United States, prosecuted and convicted for violating an arms embargo and violating the Neutrality Act. And was actually sent to prison for 18 months. But President Bush yesterday pardoned Winters for his crimes 24 years after his death.
And what motivated President Bush? Where did the request come from so long after the fact?
Well, this was a campaign that was started by Winter's son, who's also now a businessman in Florida, who remarkably knew nothing about his father's fairly colorful past. He did not know that his father was involved with the Israelis, did not know that he had actually served time in prison, and his son, Jim Winter's, working with Jewish leaders in Florida and elsewhere around the country, began mounting a campaign to have his name cleared, and they attracted some pretty big names in support, including Steven Spielberg, members of Congress, and others.
Now, this was an Irish Protestant from Boston. How did he begin this? What motivated him to get involved in this cause, in Israel's cause at the time?
You know, it's still a bit of a mystery, even to his friends and family. And I was talking to his son yesterday, as well as to Jewish leaders in Washington who say that, he apparently had a soft spot for the Israeli cause. How exactly he got involved in that, as best we can tell, there was a friend of his who was even more significant in the effort of the United States to aid the Israelis, a man by the name of Al Schwimmer, who now is still alive and lives in Israel, who brought him into the this clandestine movement, because again, this was illegal at the time. Winters became more and more involved in this, to the point that he was willing to put really his own life on the line and flying overseas.
Now, there were 18 other names on the list, people who President Bush pardoned. Do you want to tell us a little bit about them? And did it give you a sense of how Bush is considering these pardons as he gets ready to leave office?
Well, Bush has been notoriously stingy in granting pardons, only about half the rate that Clinton granted them, and among the lowest in modern history in terms of how many he's granted. The big question going into the next month's transition is whether or not any of the real prominent names out there, people like Michael Milken, Bernie Ebers from WorldCom, Marion Jones, the Olympic sprinter, and perhaps even Scooter Libby, who, unlike the others, has not even actually applied for a pardon, but whether or not those people will be granted clemency. But this is a long and involved process with thousands of people applying for petitions for clemency, going through the pardon office at the Justice Department, having their cases reviewed and examined and evaluated by lawyers before they ultimately end up at the White House and on the president's desk for consideration.
Mm-hmm.
I would be surprised if he has a personal stake in very many of these cases. The case of Charlie Winters might be a possible exception in that Bush is certainly regarded as a strong ally of Israel. And here you have a guy who 60 years ago was imprisoned for his support of Israel. But aside from that, these are unremarkable cases.
Okay, Eric Lischblau, unremarkable pardons from President Bush. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Eric Lischblau is a reporter for the New York Times, and he came to us from Maryland.
So China has a problem, and listen, you can hear it.
I really can't understand why my daughter wants to open a nail and beauty parlor. It's a disgrace to her international law major at college.
That's a mom in China bemoaning her daughter not making the most of her college degree. Well, perhaps carping about slacker graduates is a lament for parents in the West, but in China, it's a sobering issue. China has a population of educated young people that in sheer numbers rivals some industrial nations. And getting jobs for educated young people with rising expectations about their lives is a serious economic and political problem for the world's most populous nation that is also fast becoming the planet's economic engine. Joining us to discuss this conundrum for the government of China is Dr. Kerry Brown, a senior fellow in Asia research for Chatham House. He joins us from London. Dr. Brown, what is the problem for the Chinese government as you see it?
Well, basically, it's two problems. One is that they've got a generation of, kind of more aspiring, more highly educated young Chinese. And I think the second thing is that, obviously, the work market has got to expand in order to have reasonable quality jobs to take these people when they graduate. And that seems to, be very difficult at the moment, especially when there is some shrinkage, like in the rest of the world, in the labor market.
Well, listen to the voice of this 26-year-old Chinese woman who's on her third job hunt.
I think of interest in the first place. I could never do something well if I'm not interested in it. It doesn't matter if my job is steady or not. I want to try different jobs to enrich my work experience.
So that's a 26-year-old named Xuan Xuan, and she's looking for work, and she hasn't found anything that relates to her degree. And I guess, you know, the economic reforms in China created a certain kind of stability 20 years ago, but now the expectations from those reforms is potentially producing a political instability.
Yeah, I mean, this is a very important group of people that the government, the Communist Party of China, has to take a lot of notice of. And I think, you know, 20 years ago, there was some structure. People, when they went to university, they were kind of told what they were studying. And then when they graduated, they had jobs to go to. And now it's very much like a free market as it is in the West. And so I think the government knows that they can't, you know, have a lot of disaffected students going around who might be starting to think, well, this system isn't working, and starting to ask questions that, you know, the government wouldn't want them to ask.
How is the government making this a high priority, getting jobs for college graduates, and how much of a time bomb is this politically?
Well, it's trying to build, you know, what you call a knowledge economy, so getting away from, you know, more manufacturing jobs to jobs which involve research and development using people's technical capacity. China produces a lot of mathematicians, a lot of scientists. It's also taken, you know, a million students who've gone abroad. A lot of those have gone back now, and they're contributing to the Chinese economy. But it's really a question of how quickly this process can go. And with the global downturn, China's got to do these things a lot more quickly maybe than it expected it would have to.
And the entire world is depending on China to remain stable and to become this economic engine that everyone hopes that it will as a way out of this recession. 20 years ago next year is the anniversary of the Tiananmen Square uprising. Suddenly we've got a generation of students with much more complex and realistic expectations about what should happen in their country. What is the likelihood that something like Tiananmen Square might happen again? And what kind of students and workers would we see in those crowds this time around, if you can imagine?
Well, 20 years ago, the issue was high inflation and corruption, and those issues are still there. Inflation less so, but corruption is still a big deal, and the current government under President Hu has tried to really clamp down on corruption amongst officials. I think if you've got workers and students coming together, that's a pretty much a nightmare scenario. There are still high levels of unrest in China because of people being laid off with the manufacturing downturn, especially in South China. And also, you've got 200 to 300 million migrant workers who are a big unknown. If they start protesting, then you could get an incredibly difficult situation very, very quickly.
And, you know, again, 20 years ago next year, the Tiananmen Square echo. Dr. Kerry Brown, thanks so much for giving us some context there. It's a fascinating, very interesting stuff.
Thanks very much. Thanks, Sam. Bye.
Dr. Kerry Brown is a senior fellow at Asia Research for Chatham House. He joined us from London talking about the very great difficulty in finding jobs for the millions of college graduates in China in the middle of an economic downturn.
And there's just no blueprint.
That's right. There's no blueprint.
Right.
And the expectations they have are perhaps completely unrealistic in this new economic environment. So there's a limit to what the Chinese government can even do.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's a holiday week. Today is Christmas Eve. We're thinking about holiday music. So many of you have sent us your favorite songs, the songs that you hate. Our friend Jack Grace has created his own holiday jukebox from Hades. And we wanted to hear songs that you like, that you love.
This is Anita from Riverdale. My favorite Christmas song is the Tom Lehrer Christmas Carol, the one that starts Christmas time is here. By golly, just a fool would be folly. Deck the halls with hunks of holly, fill the cup and don't say when.
Kill the turkeys, ducks, and chickens. Mix the punch, drag out the dickens. Even though the prospect sickens, brother, here we go again.
That musical mathematician Tom Lehrer, send us your best of the holiday season, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. So during the holidays, we think about food as much as we think about music, and nothing defines a nation as much as its food, its dietary practices, the way it cultivates food. And Barack Obama, who ran, as you recall, on a platform of change.
Yeah, I remember
right?
that.
We all remember that. It was an opportunity for lots of people in lots of different spheres of American life to petition the new administration and say, well, here are some changes, and food is no different from anything else in American policy, and foodies around the United States have actually tried to gauge what potential for change there is in the way we deal with food in this country. Kim Severson of the New York Times writes about what the foodies want from this new administration, kind of a foodie manifesto story. Kim, thanks for joining us.
Oh, glad to be here.
From Steamboat Springs, Colorado. I'm actually pretty jealous of where you are this holiday season.
A lot of nice snow out here, let me tell you that. It's a Christmas miracle.
Well, how do you assess what it is, first of all, that foodies might want from a new administration and what is likely to change in the very broad, and I guess it's fair to say, cultural set of practices that constitute how Americans approach, consume, and cultivate food?
Well, the foodanistas or the food progressives, I'm not sure any term but foodies, I guess, is a good one for me. But they started immediately. Ruth Reichel, who's the editor of Gourmet, Alice Waters, who's a very famous restaurateur from California, and Danny Meyer, who's a restaurant mogul in New York City, all got together immediately after Obama was elected and wrote him a letter offering to be his kitchen cabinet and help him select a White House chef who would have sustainable a sustainable ethic, who would cook local food, and who could really set the tone. So this idea that what the president eats can affect how we eat is a pretty strong one. Some more serious efforts came up. There were lobbying for who he should choose for agriculture secretary. This has gone from the little slightly ridiculous, which was to nominate Michael Pollan, who has repeatedly said that perhaps he wouldn't be the best person to run a $97 billion budget.
Yeah, food stamps for Michael Pollan might be
right,
a little tough to
I can't
pull off there.
Really imagine what that meeting would be like, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. So and then there's some more serious efforts. There's a group of people who started with Paul Willis, who's a kind of a famous pig farmer, started selling his pork through Nyman Ranch and now sells a lot of his pork to Chipotle, and a couple other folks in Iowa who decided they would put forth a list of people they thought should be Secretary of Agriculture. Now, as we know, last week their wishes did not come true.
So the early indications are not good for this change in practices.
It's interesting. People are like, well, you know, his family, you know, Michelle Obama talked about how she doesn't like high fructose corn syrup and she likes to eat organic. And, you know, he's got Rahm Emanuel, who's his chief of staff, belongs to a community-supported agriculture program through a synagogue. And there's all these indications that Obama is the guy, the foodie guy. You know, he's quoted Michael Pollan in interviews. But his first choice was very much a centrist choice. You know, Tom Vilsack, who was likes biotechnology. He likes ethanol. He certainly works with big farm interests, with big agriculture. So there was a sense of, well, give Obama a chance. This is a centrist. And then some people just were, that was it. It was, you know, the dream is dead.
Well, what about some high-profile symbolic things, such as maybe a vegetable garden on the White House lawn? Or Alice Waters, of course, has a famous food cultivation program in high schools in the Bay Area.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe
mm-hmm.
that would be a part of Obama's educational program.
You know, it would be really easy if he took, and there's a campaign out there, too. This is another part of the thing, to turn one or two of the 17 acres of White House garden into an organic vegetable garden, to have the first garden, if you will. It would be terrific. I think it would go a long way to saying this is an important part of our culture. How we eat food is important. He could certainly direct the education department to start to think about incorporating gardening and farming into curriculum and to see if somehow in the school food program, which is now under USDA, if there could be a local initiative. So school districts could, say, maybe get a break if they buy a certain percentage of their food locally. There's a lot that he could do.
I guess the sense is that the opportunity is great, because certain symbolic gestures may actually trickle down in a big way.
I think it's true. It's always the one small thing, you know, that can make big change, especially in this country, and especially I think when people are really hungry for, well, I shouldn't say it's a terrible pun, but are looking for a way to change what they eat. And if you look at the rise in farmers markets over the last 4 or 5 years, after the last decade, you know, there are 4,000 or 5,000 farmers markets that weren't in existence 10, 20 years ago. People obviously are interested in changing how they eat. And so if the president says, we're going to try to eat mostly, I want a chef who cooks mostly organic in my kitchen. We're going to feature local American food at every state dinner. We could go a long way, I think.
Do you think, Kim, that these individuals would support explicit subsidies for organic food to bring the price down, to maybe bring them more in line with non-organic alternatives?
Well, I think people are looking at that. There's nothing more complex. Well, I'm sure there are a few things more complex, but the way farm subsidies and the way agricultural subsidies work in this country are very difficult, and the way that the government ties in inexpensive food with many of its feeding programs is going to be a hard one to unravel. So, you know, the government subsidizes certain kinds of agriculture to produce, to get a certain amount of production. There's extra food. That food goes into the schools as a commodity program. Well, that food is not always not necessarily the healthiest food. So there'd be a subsidy so that organic foods were less expensive, Bruce, possibly. I think you could. And again, you
and again, the symbolism is the key here. Maybe a gesture
right.
in, you know, one class of foods
right.
in the schools.
Local procurement, you know,
right.
that school districts that procure their food locally will get a certain break. That could go a long way.
All right.
The
symbolic versus the policy. All the foodies are going to be paying attention as they, you know, contemplate their holiday dinners. Kim Severson, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, great to be here, and you guys have a good rest of the week.
We sure will. Kim Severson, reporter for the New York Times. She spoke to us from Steamboat Springs, Colorado. And now headlines from Femi Okay.
Good morning. The time is 28 minutes past the hour. Dow futures up 42 points. Market opens in just under 2 minutes' time. We do have some new economic data out this morning. And lumps of coal, unfortunately, rather than gifts from the economy, all points to things getting worse. So new unemployment claims went up more than expected. Consumer spending fell for the fifth straight month, and big-ticket manufacturing orders fell 1%. And President Bush has granted the second-ever posthumous presidential pardon on record. It goes to Charles Winters, who was jailed for sending military planes to Israel after World War II. More news in 10 minutes.
Thanks, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. This week, the U.S. leading diplomat on Africa, Jendai Frazier, called on embattled Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe to step down. Mugabe didn't respond directly to her, but he did have words for President Bush.
Let him keep his comments to himself. They are undeserved, irrelevant, and quite stupid and foolish.
That's a defiant Mugabe in the face of increasing international calls from Britain to religious leaders in South Africa for Mugabe to resign. The country is facing a deadly cholera outbreak, a crumbling economy, and massive instability. We turn to journalist Heidi Holland, the author of Dinner with Mugabe, the untold story of a freedom fighter who became a tyrant. Her book is based on face-to-face interviews with Mugabe. She joins us from Natal, South Africa, with some insight. Welcome, Heidi.
Thank you very much.
You say that there is some logic to his quote-unquote madness.
Well, you know, a lot of what he says, ironically, is based on truth, in the sense that he does feel betrayed by Britain, in particular the former colonial power. And he plays on the sanctions that have been introduced by the West in general and Britain in particular, and by recent attempts, for example, to call for his removal or his blaming him in particular for what has gone on. And all of that is true from the West point of view, but unfortunately, Tony Blair, the former British Prime Minister, did in fact have a regime change agenda originally in Zimbabwe in 2000, where, as your listeners know, regime change was quite fashionable in the world. So unfortunately, the Western pressure, which humiliates Mugabe, introduces more sanctions, merely feeds his propaganda machine. He makes a lot of capital from it, and a lot of Africans, including many of the African leaders, actually believe him.
Describe what it's like to sit down and have a conversation with him. The first word that comes to mind that he's most been described as lately is delusional.
Yes, I think he's delusional, but it's not immediately apparent. He's actually very quiet, very, very shy man, actually, has been all his life. And when I asked him whether that was his personality, he said very readily it was. The first impression you get of him is of a very lonely person, very watchful. He doesn't like to be contradicted. You know, I was with him for 2.5 hours, and I contradicted him several times. And you can actually see his eyes blaze with anger. So he's a scary guy. I also think very, very immature man, very damaged man. He had an extremely deprived childhood, and I think this is a lot of what you see playing out. As a result, you know, one does wonder, watching this imploding country and these poor people suffering increasingly, you do wonder if perhaps it's time for diplomacy to actually look at who they're dealing with rather than requiring that he become a responsible person, which he never will.
You said by humiliating Mugabe, you think that Britain and the U.S. has actually moved him further away from any potential compromise or any agreement to step down from power. Do you want to explain that?
Yes, definitely. I think this is a man who reacts extremely badly to humiliation and the denigration of him that has been going on for a long time now, since 2000. I mean, it's going on for 9 years, has, I think, been completely dysfunctional. The people who pay for his anger in response to the humiliation piled on by the West are ordinary Zimbabweans, because he's very vengeful and he takes it out on them. My own feeling, and I said this in an op-ed piece in the New York Times way back in April this year, my own feeling is that Britain in particular, because they have some leverage with him given the history, should speak to Mugabe. They should make peace with Mugabe. He doesn't deserve it, but, somebody's got to be a grown-up, and it isn't going to be him.
Well, Heidi, is it possible then that this delusional character who ignores cholera but, never misses an opportunity to respond to some slight that he sees from George Bush or the U.K., is actually a creation of these Western leaders who have humiliated him so much? Or do do Zimbabweans have a way of holding their leader accountable?
No, I don't think they do. I mean, of course, they could go on a rampage and do something drastic. But first of all, they're very depleted now that there are many, many people there are on the brink of starvation. Many have actually left the country and legged it simply because they need to survive. So I think there's only a tiny bit of leverage, and maybe not at all, but as long as there is a window of opportunity, I think it behoves the British government to take it. And that is that Robert Mugabe is 85 years old in a couple of months' time. He spent half his life under British colonialism, trying to be the sort of zenith of human achievement at the time, an English gentleman. And he deeply, deeply resents the fact that the British cast him out nearly a decade ago. He feels completely betrayed by the British. Now, I'm not saying it's the Britain's fault. Clearly, it's Mugabe's fault. But at what point does one become pragmatic in order to save probably a lot of lives? You know, we constantly think that it can't get any worse, but actually, frankly, it's got worse and worse and will continue to get worse.
I think there's a lot of agreement with that last part of what you said, Heidi. It just seems like it can't get worse, and it does. Heidi Holland, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Heidi Holland is a journalist and author of Dinner with Mugabe, the untold story of a freedom fighter who became a tyrant. We turn now to Femi Okeh, who's got the headlines.
And the time is just coming up to 21 minutes to the top of the hour. A new report from the Obama transition team says that they had no inappropriate contact with Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich. They say that the incoming chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel, was the only team member to speak with the governor. Blagojevich is accused of trying to sell the president-elect's vacant seat. An Indian judge has ordered the only surviving gunman from the Mumbai attacks to stay in police custody for another 2 weeks. Police are still investigating the shootings. Airports are ready for holiday travellers today. Ellen Howe from the Transportation Security Administration says that airport security has been beefed up and compares the next few days of travel to a sporting event.
The holidays for us are like our version of the Super Bowl.
So winter weather continues to harm travel plans, though, throughout the country. Snow in the Midwest caused hundreds of flight delays in Chicago yesterday and car accidents.
I'm trying to get my head around that. Yeah. The TSA says that the holidays are the Super Bowl for them.
It's a mega event.
Now, are they the offensive line and we're trying to get through and they're blocking us?
What's going on there? Could you do it in a cricket analogy?
Or we're on the bottom of the pile or something.
She was feeling very confident about it.
Too deeply.
It's hurting me. Yeah, I mean, pain.
Clearly.
Sorry.
We're going to try to alleviate that. So you get an A for effort there, Femi.
All right. Very good. Meanwhile, winter weather continues to harm travel plans throughout the country. We have snow in the Midwest, and that's caused hundreds of flight delays in Chicago yesterday. And car accidents caused by freezing rain throughout the Midwest have left at least 12 people dead. And also heading in towards the Great Lakes region and also up through towards the Northeast, we have winter weather advisory. So take care out there. That's a look at your news for now.
Thanks, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji. And all over the country, as many of you know, there is lots of snow falling. In Seattle, for example, very unfamiliar pictures over the weekend of snow falling, icy streets. But one resident says she's getting around easier than her neighbors. Carla Salter takes buses everywhere. Is that right, Carla?
Yes.
So you've developed a real enthusiasm for public transportation.
Oh, absolutely, yes.
And your blog is called Bus Chick.
Yes.
And you write it for the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. Now, What is it about the buses that you enjoy so much?
Well, I'll try to say this as concisely as possible. It's just, I think of buses, and I know this is probably considered odd, I think of them as extremely romantic. There's just something about, you know, being on, you have all these people who are coming from, you know, different economic backgrounds, different walks of life. You don't know where they're coming from. You don't know where they're going to. And they probably have nothing more in common than this shared ride, but they're all thrown together for this period of time and togetherness. And I just find it endlessly interesting. So.
Yeah, that does sound a bit romantic. So how is it working for you
in
all of
that romantic
snow?
That doesn't sound romantic. So you and your husband, like, say, hey, honey, let's go jump on a bus?
Well, there are many things that are also romantic aside from riding the bus. And I don't mean romantic in that way, although I did meet my husband on the bus. But I just mean romantic in a sort of generic sense, in the sort of.
Anyway, sorry for interrupting.
In a community sense, I think that's what you meant, right?
Exactly,
that you enjoy this experience that you wouldn't have if you were sitting in your car by yourself listening to music
Absolutely.
Or talking on the telephone.
Exactly. I'm on the ground in my community. I'm out seeing what's going on.
But is it convenient?
There are many other benefits, too.
Is it convenient?
Well, you know, what I find about Seattle is kind of a middle-of-the-road city. I mean, it's not New York. You know, it's kind of a middle-of-the-road city in terms of getting around because we don't own a car at all. So it can be done. It certainly can be done, but you have to plan by where you live and sort of plan your life in a way that makes it more convenient. It's not Houston or Detroit or a place where it's almost impossible to get around on transit, but it's not New York or Chicago either. So what I find it's not transit that's inherently inconvenient. It's sort of the way our city is built around cars more than anything.
And you intentionally got rid of your car because you didn't want to keep polluting the environment, right?
Yes, it was, you know, and what I found, too, after I've been car-free for almost 6 years, is cars impact the environment in so many ways beyond just pollution and traffic. I mean, they basically change the built environment completely and how you interact with your community and how much exercise you get. So I found it's just profoundly and positively changed my life. I would never go back, even though now I have a child.
Well, I was going to say, now that you have a 13-month-old, is it still as good for you to take the bus?
Well, see, my child loves the bus. And I feel like is that I'm imparting my values to her without having to say a word, values of community, equality, environmental stewardship, you know, regular exercise, all of it. And she hasn't been deprived of any advantage or experience that other kids who have cars have, but I feel like she's being educated and enriched in ways that other kids are not.
That is great.
Well, thank you very much, Carla, for sharing your story.
You're welcome.
Carla Salter writes the Bus Chick blog for the Seattle Post-Intelligencer.
Thank you very much.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Christmas Eve. That means it's December 24th, and Femi Oke is here with the headlines of the hour.
And the time is just coming up to 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Wall Street is closing early today for the holidays. Dow is currently trading at up 32 points and the S&P up about 1.19 points. The Labour Department says that initial jobless claims rose to a 26-year high last week. And at the same time, the Commerce Department says consumer spending fell for a fifth straight month, and while durable goods orders also fell. All of those numbers came in this morning. South African leaders are calling for a resolution to the power dispute in Zimbabwe. The leader of South Africa's ruling party has called for a quick end to what he calls an untenable situation. And finally, if you're off shopping today, you're being some pretty good company. I'm going to dig into the science file for this last story and some intriguing news about orangutans and shopping. Now, so just setting the scene here for you. And apparently, orangutans do understand the concept of shopping. That's according to researchers in Scotland. So they gave orangutans some tokens for food. And in order to get the food, they exchanged the tokens. So they understood exactly what shopping was about. Although I don't think they'll be hitting the stores this afternoon.
That's utterly preposterous. It's just getting a reward.
I'm not sure what to make of that.
Rats who get bananas are like shopping? I don't think so.
Anyhow.
So
they give a token, then they get some food. That's shopping.
Thank you, Femi.
Thanks, Femi.
You're welcome.
Each year, the New York Times Magazine seeks voices to convey the big and little details of what transpired in the previous 12 months. It's usually a mix of the hugely important, the surprising, the irresistible, and the poignantly sad. And among those assigned to write for this Sunday's year-end issue is NBC News' Tom Brokaw, now a special correspondent for the network and former anchor of the NBC Evening News. Tom, under any circumstances, would have plenty to say about this year, but at the center of 2008 for you is the loss of colleague Tim Russert. Tom, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, John. It was a startling moment and a terribly sad moment for all of us that afternoon when we got word that Tim had collapsed in the Washington Bureau and could not be revived. And I suppose out of all of this, what would give Tim the greatest pride is how everybody who worked for him on the Russert team rallied so magnificently and got through the rest of the year. And we always had a feeling that Tim was there beside us in one form or another. So it was a difficult time, but he died at the peak of his life. He was doing what he loved to do best. No one did it better. And he'd come a long way from South Buffalo, but he never forgot from whence he came.
And for all of the elections that I can recall, and we were colleagues for a while at NBC, you know, dreary, boring elections that really didn't have the significance of 2008, to have missed this one really was a heartbreaker, I think, for all of us political junkies out there.
It was true in Tim's case. On the other hand, he had a great run from the beginning of it until that day that we lost him. And I've said about Tim, not entirely in jest, there's that old joke about nobody on their deathbed says, gee, I wish I'd spent more time at the office. In Tim's case, he wished he'd spent more time at the office. He just loved it so much.
Tom, it certainly was an extraordinary year in so many ways. When you look back now, how would you sum it up?
The year was a lot about prologue. It was really about leading to this historic election in November, and then the telltale signs, the tremors, if you will, of this economic dislocation that we're going through. This is more than a passing cycle, and we don't know quite how it's going to settle in yet. So I think a combination of both this historic election, the country beginning to pay more attention to its political destiny again on an individual basis, and then the underpinning of the American economy, the financial system, just bursting at the seams, in a matter of speaking, throwing all the bolts, and we don't know, you know, what it's going to be like 9 months from now.
In the time since 1974, when Nixon resigned, the last real just tumultuous moment, I think it's fair to say, in American presidential politics,
right.
The media has proliferated, and it's gone through a period of both explosive growth, but also a reputation for persistent superficiality. As we emerge into these extraordinary challenges that you've described, do you think the media is ready to handle this story, the Obama story and the financial story?
Well, I hope so. I think that we have to be careful that we don't look just at all the new forms of media, just the blogging and the internet sites. We do have to pay attention to the old traditional media and hope that we can find a way that it can survive. One of the concerns that I have, John, is that we're losing our attention span in this country because of the manner in which we communicate with each other and our expectations when it comes to retrieving some information that may be helpful. We're not looking for more than four or five lines or a text message. These are much more complicated issues that we're dealing with now. When I was in Washington about a year ago talking to some senators on the Hill, they said with some sense of alarm that they're not getting any young people, however bright they are or whatever great institutions they may come from, who are reading books these days. I've been judging some journalistic competition, and I've been really gratified to see how much good work is being done out there. But at the end of the day, I wonder who's reading this stuff, because people are just hitting and moving on. And we need to do both at our end a better job, but also the news consumers, as I describe them, have to be a little more aggressive about how they approach what they get and how they use it.
Well, suddenly we have a pointy-headed professor from my old alma mater, the University of Chicago, in the White House. Do you think Barack Obama, and you've had a lot of contact with him, do you think he has the capacity to lead American discourse back to something that requires a greater attention span?
I actually do, and I think he's going to use the White House as a bully pulpit. He had that capacity during the course of the primary. I think it served him very well. He didn't seem to be just another conventional politician who would say whatever happened to suit whatever audience he was in front of. I've often said this year that I'm not quite sure what this phrase means, but I think he's a postmodern candidate and president. If I were to say there was a modern candidate, I suppose it would be Hillary Clinton. I think that John McCain, for example, was more of a traditional candidate. Then you put Hillary in the modern sense of the word of a candidate, and then you take Barack Obama, given where he comes from, how he ran the campaign, the use of all this IT that is available to him now, and so skillfully and so effectively, I think that we probably will see from him and in the White House the kind of moderator of a national dialogue, or at least I hope so.
Some of our contributors have described it as saying smart is back in the White House.
I think that's true. I think there's curiosity back in the White House. Smart is back in the White House. You have to be careful, however. I've just been reading a wonderful book called Lessons in Disaster by a young man. I think his name is Goldstein, and it's about McGeorge Bundy and the terrible advice that he gave to John Kennedy and then to Lyndon Johnson. He was widely regarded as the smartest man in the Eastern Seaboard and maybe in the country. Everybody thought that they were the best and brightest, as David Halberstam so memorably described them. These are the people who led us into Vietnam. When John Kennedy first got in office, he signed off on the Bay of Pigs. you know, we have to be careful. Smart also has to be practical.
Although the difference there is McGeorge Bundy was an advisor, and in this particular case, Barack Obama, perhaps the smartest of the bunch in his administration, is actually the decider. He's in the White House.
I think that's true. And I think also, John, that they're very mindful in the Obama group of the mistakes of the past 50 years of our lifetime. These are so contemporary for most of us. We are positioned to move the country now into a new era, and we all have our fingers crossed. And as I've been saying as I go around the country, it can't be just from the top down. It also has to be from the bottom up. So I've been encouraging audiences to, as I describe it, re-enlist as citizens and take control of your destiny.
Well, re-enlist. That's a good one. I think good. That's a perfect takeaway, Tom.
I actually love the metaphor of postmodern defeating modern. That gives hope to Jackson Pollock competing for legacy with Pablo Picasso, perhaps. Tom Brokaw, thanks so much for joining us.
Okay, gang. It's always a pleasure.
He's in our gang. Tom Brokaw, special correspondent for NBC News, and his piece remembering his colleague Tim Russert, host of Meet the Press, is in this Sunday's New York Times Magazine.
So, today is the last day of one of our colleagues and friend, Jonathan Dyer from the BBC, and it's bittersweet.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's leaving us. It's not his last day on Earth.
No, his last day with us here at The Takeaway, which is sad.
And he has a name he likes to be called.
Nigel Small Widebottom.
I'm very accurate, might I say.
And well, and continuing with the sort of soliciting holiday songs, we asked Jonathan what his favorite song of the season is, and this is what he loves.
Oh, it's the most wonderful time of the year.
Man, Jonathan, we are going to miss you, dude. I mean, he's going back to Boston. He's going to be doing radio. He's going to be making public radio better, as he always has.
But he won't be here.
And he won't be making the voice of this show as sharp, as smart, and it's just emotionally riveting, as he does every single day. We're going to miss you, Jonathan.
We will miss you, Jonathan.
We will miss you, Jonathan.
And we got a takeaway.
Unfortunately, the Western pressure, which humiliates Mugabe, introduces more sanctions, merely feeds his propaganda machine.
Heidi Holland, journalist and author of Dinner with Mugabe. Jonathan is going to be so mad at us for that. I'm John Hockenberry.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway,